All right, good morning and welcome to this. Seb, good morning. Come in. I think there's some chairs here and there's a chair right here, so do please come in. Welcome to this seventh and final class, an exploration of Dr. King's writings, his speeches, sermons, and sayings. We've been exploring for 7 weeks using this volume, The Radical King. Today is our last class, and we're going to do a bit of an overview, hopefully, after we look at or think about the sermon, the last sermon he ever gave the night before his assassination. On April 3rd, 1968, he delivered a sermon in Memphis that was remarkably, extraordinarily prophetic in the sense of calling forth or anticipating his own death mere hours away. So we'll do that. But before we do, let's listen per Joan. I think Joan was the one who recommended. Poignant way in our custom in this class to listen to a bit of music to start our class. Today we listen to Strange Fruit, made famous by Billie Holiday, first sung in 1939, which is extraordinary. I read up a little bit on it this last week, and she would end her shows with it. The show would end. She would come back on stage. They would turn off all the lights. She would be spotlit only on her face. She would sing it with minimal accompaniment, and there would be no encores. That was it. That was the way the show ended, 1939. No one would record it. She couldn't get anybody to record it at first. None of her usual production companies, none of her recording labels with whom she had worked would record it at first. Eventually it was recorded in 1939 and then made famous. She, of course, made it famous. I also love Nina Simone's version, which is extraordinary as well, but it is what it is because of Billie Holiday. Today, we wrap up our class, and so recognizing how little time we have, I want to jump right into it. The reading assignment was the last chapter of the book, Radical King. I invited you to read Revelation chapters 21 and the first few verses of chapter 22 about the New Jerusalem, and in particular because if you noticed, if you read both, no quizzes today, but if you read both, then you would notice that he makes mention of preachers and the instrumental role of preachers in Memphis, because that's where it was delivered, of actually being having a relevant ministry. He uses the expression, a relevant ministry. And not just talking about the New Jerusalem, but talking about the New New York, the New Philadelphia, the New Atlanta, the New Birmingham, the New Memphis. Not just looking for great by and by in the sky, but looking for a restoration and recreation in the cities of our world today. And so thinking about the juxtaposition of that biblical image with the reality. I wonder, as we begin this last class, what stood out to you? How many of you had ever read or heard this sermon before? Oh, more than a few of you, about a third of you. Okay. For those who had read it or heard it before, and for those who read it or heard it in this past week for the very first time, I wonder, did anything new stand out to you? Did any elements or rhetorical tools or devices, images, anything stand out in a new way? Or what, for those of you for whom it was the first time you ever read it, what jumped out to you? Please, yeah, Cherry.
It was just amazing to me that I had not noticed before. It really was extemporaneous.
Yeah.
I noticed when he said, Jesse, go cut up bread.
Yeah.
It was extemporaneous.
Brilliant man. Yeah. Yeah.
And he repeated some of the things he had in other sermons.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
But
we all.
I don't. I never do that. I'm sure.
You. If you haven't yet, you will.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. An extraordinary piece of oratory delivered completely. Without a scratch of notes, and drawing threads of phrases and ideas, images that he had used and utilized and that were quite familiar, and also clearly not just speaking his regular stump speech, because he's speaking about Memphis. He's speaking about the unique circumstances and why he's there and what they're up to, and naming people and talking about what they needed to do, what they had done, what this was still left to do. It was really remarkable. Did someone else? Yeah, Alan.
I kept thinking of his identification with Moses.
Yeah. Can you say more?
Well, Moses, obviously the mountaintop.
Well, not obviously. What does that mean?
Well, Moses didn't get to the promised land. He died on the mountaintop overlooking it.
I may not get there
with you, but I will, as a people, we will get to the mountain. We mm-hmm. will get to the promised land.
Mm-hmm. And does everyone understand that? What this, that when we talk about I've been to the mountaintop, that is a direct homage to Moses,
okay,
who leads the people through the wilderness for 40 years, but for particular reasons does not get to enter into the promised land, and his last surveying of it is from Mount Nebo. Traditionally, in Jordan, so on the east side of the Jordan River, and gazing down at the valley, the Jordan Valley, where Jericho is, and that is his only side of the Promised Land, is on this side. He never gets to inhabit it. So thinking, really critically thinking about what it means for Dr. King to draw an analogy there, less than 24 hours from the day when he would be prevented from entering into any deeper into the promised land. Alan, please keep going. Sorry about that.
I think he was given the gift of knowing his vocation at that moment. Maybe there were times when he doubted, but at that moment, I think he was secure in his vocation, in his calling from God as to what his life was about.
Yeah. Thank you. Others, yes, please, Ashley.
One thing I noticed, and this is kind of small in comparison to some of the other things, but he has a lot of sarcastic humor going on in this thing.
Can you give an example?
They seldom got around to mentioning the fact that 1,000
embraces. Yes. Yeah, 1,300.
Bailo was in dire need of a doctor. They didn't get around to that. And then also, we turned Bull Connor into a steer. And
I loved that. I loved that. And you know that brought the house down.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's such a... Yeah, that was great.
Lots of amens on that.
Oh, I bet. Please, Michael.
I'm struck, not just this one in particular, but a lot of them, having read the prophets vocationally in every other way.
Yeah.
And thought about them. And we liberals often want to say, well, the prophets were simply, they weren't getting any special insight into the future, but simply talking about things.
Sure.
But here I see King revealed as the kind of prophets that we traditionally think of, who actually are given an insight far beyond now, as well as being able to interpret what's happening now in terms of God, but also God giving them this a way to see
a vision,
and not just this thing about his death, but the whole vision, which again you see at the end of Revelation, the same kind of of vision that's not yet, but still is to come.
Yeah, prophets, some simply want to ascribe to the prophets no supernatural capacity to see things that anybody couldn't see, and simply an ability to sort of connect the dots. If you do A, then B happens. It's just like, you know, math. And therefore, the prophets are simply people who lay plain to a society, you are doing this, what's going to happen is this. If you want to suck out all the sort of mystical, supernatural from it, then that would be how you could make sense of it. That prophets laid plain the consequences, the natural consequences of a society's actions. But there is, in the biblical tradition, clearly not just a, if A, then B. There is clearly also, if A, then B, but also God is in there somewhere, and the prophets have a unique capacity to see where God enters in and changes the course of history. And prophets can see that and grasp it and communicate about it. Cherry, please, yeah?
I think he was also referring to the fact that if he's not, he may not make it to the promised land, but all those people who left Egypt did not make it to the promised land.
Indeed.
In fact, there was
a whole generation. And it was their duty to train up their children, et cetera, et cetera, to go on with the thing, with the mission, and he had some of those people who were going to carry it on right there before him. You can go on without me.
Ever since Dr. Waters' talk last Wednesday. And by the way, those of you who are actually not going on the pilgrimage, I want to share with you the remarkable development. Those of you who though heard Dr. Waters deliver last Wednesday's address, in following up with him, trying to get some extra recommendations on who we should meet and what we should do in Alabama and Mississippi, he said, well, I could go with you. And I said, okay. So it turns out he's been leading trips just like this for 15 years, and he was like, rather than me just like give you a bunch of names and phone numbers, I could go with you. So Dr. Michael Waters, the founding pastor of Joy Tabernacle, will be coming with us. And what he talked about last Wednesday, which was so I have been disheartened, but in the way that a person coming down out of a drunk and finding sobriety is disheartened, if that makes sense. It's the clarity of a clear head and clear sight I have been disheartened ever since last Wednesday by realizing that 50 years later, we're not really much further along. And so thinking about the analogy of Moses to this scenario, and Dr. King being the Moses to this storyline that we are continuing to move and yet not quite yet inhabiting, and that we are teaching and raising up a generation who one day will inhabit, right? That those of us who live now may not yet fully enter in to the promised land of equity, of the full dignity of all persons, of a society that is truly just, but it is still our responsibility nevertheless to prepare the next subsequent generations to do so. Yeah. What a powerful sort of, as you tease the thread of that metaphor out, you realize just how resonant it is for now. Other thoughts? Please, yes.
I know I haven't been to the classes, but, you know, I grew up in the King era, and my great-grandfather was Martin's classmate, and the wives were classmates, and my dad is a mentor for Martin Luther. So I grew up with this, my parents, Marge Selma and everything, and we studied this all the time because it was a means of being Facebook back in the day. The church was very powerful, as it always was. And when you talk about, you know, the plantations and the plantations owners, their biggest fear that was to keep the people ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
But ministers or traveling ministers or priests, they could read.
Mm-hmm.
They could read better than the slave owners.
Mm-hmm.
And they talked about, particularly after the second migration, when African Americans were free and able to migrate, like you said, Philadelphia, New
mm-hmm.
York, Chicago,
mm-hmm.
because those are the great training lines that came out of the Mississippi Valley. But they talked about Martin Luther didn't want to be, quote-unquote, the figure for the civil rights movement, nor did Moses want to have the burden of leading people to a land on a journey that he didn't even know mm-hmm. existed. But they had strong faith. And because Martin grew up in a very profound family of faith, they always believed. And most importantly, he was really, really frightened when he went to Memphis. But he said, you know, those people ask me.
Mm-hmm.
We've already had one failure, two failures in trying to make things happen in Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
We can do this without violence. We do it with love. And like you said, he was not prepared, nor did he want to. He was fearful to go out because he had had numerous threats prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
But
he was not blind to the possibility.
Right. I mean,
yeah.
You know, we use the term, I'm a military guy, he just put the shield of the Lord on.
Mm-hmm.
And he went out and he spoke very fluently and eloquently about his beliefs. And it was very, very powerful, but it was foretelling, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But we looked at the fact that he didn't want to be out in front.
Hmm.
But he accepted the burden and said, because I don't always know what is before me, but I will accept the challenge if you present it to me. And that was his faith.
Yeah.
And, you know, he stood. And all those references about foreseeing and mm-hmm. the mountaintop and those kinds of things was really, really meaningful to us as a people, because my parents said, I'm doing better for you to have better.
Mm.
And that's what was taught in my family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were a mixed family, and people don't even know that, you know, there was a lot of inbreeding and breeding and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of strife, but your faith is stronger than you ever realize, and it will overtake color or hate or any of those kinds of things. And so, you know, we would dine and talk about those things mm-hmm. all the time. And I didn't know, you know, and I'm a 66-year-old man now. Imagine it as a 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old individual listening to those kinds of things, because we were seen and not heard
mm-hmm.
back in my day.
Mm-hmm.
But you listened to him.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sir.
Thank you.
May I ask you a question? With your family's
connection. Will you say it nice and loud?
With your family's connection with Martin Luther King, what I mean, he came home after all his education to be a pastor and a preacher to a specific congregation. What's the moment when he couldn't settle for just doing that? Do we know? I should read them.
Well, I think you have some homework. I think the tipping point was the bombing in Montgomery.
Okay.
I think, as we reflect, that was the tipping point. He could not comprehend how you could harm children, regardless of, and he was just kind of thrust in that position.
Well, and you get that because you know he came. He was out of town, and he came back to his parents' house first.
Yes, sir.
And they pled with him not to even go back. And when he insisted, then his father went with him. And I remember that. So, okay, thank you.
And you have to remember this, too. They had the largest congregation of people of color. And that scared people who weren't of color. When you can get, at the time, 300-400 African-Americans, Negroes together, that scared people to death.
Oh, yeah.
Scared them to death. And when that tragedy happened, it just thrust him in a position. And he talks about that. I don't know. I'm sure you have in his other readings, but I wasn't prepared.
That was another case of the whole world is watching.
He said, I was not prepared. 25-year PhD.
John, please.
I was sort of struck by how I turned the Good Samaritan story around and help people understand the fear of participating.
Yeah.
He was, the point of the speech was to get people to participate in the march on Monday, or they would have to leave work or school or whatever, and that fear, he turned the people who passed by and identified with that fear and said, okay.
If you have your book, if you brought it, 272-273, he unpacks the Good Samaritan, the parable of the Good Samaritan.
You should not stop to help others. You have to think what will happen to them.
So let's read that. We're on 272. He's trying to figure out, and he plays with in a humorous way, again, using sarcasm, using humor as a homiletical tool. A good preacher uses humor to sort of lighten the room a little bit. Why it is that the priest and the Levite did what they did. Then he says, but I'm going to tell you what my imagination tells me. It's possible that these men were afraid. You see, the Jericho Road is a dangerous road. And then he remembers, he recounts having been there with his wife, driven it in the 1960s. So he's seen it, and he understands the way it descends 3,600 feet down to essentially the lowest place on earth, the Dead Sea. That's a dangerous road. In the days of Jesus, it came to be known as the Bloody Pass. And it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking, and he was acting like he'd been robbed and hurt in order to seize them over there and lure them there for quick and easy seizure. And so the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's the question before you tonight. Not, if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to all the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not, if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? If I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question. Us preaching right there. Actually, that's what they say. He stopped preaching somewhere in there and he just started meddling.
You said something interesting in that passage, though. The police, if you really want to start correlating things, their biggest fear is we have to crush them physically. And Martin says, we can outnumber them peacefully. To the point that their violence will be a moot point. And the teachings of younger people, where there was a real uprising with college-educated young people that didn't really have a focal point or a leadership to pull upon. And his message cryptic as it was understood by those that were really engaged in that struggle and what it means to be treated with respect. And we don't mind doing your dirty work, but you're going to respect us because.
We have power in numbers. And he goes wonderfully into that. Amanda, I'm going to come to you. I'm sorry. He goes wonderfully into that, inviting the crowd there that day after two, well pointed out earlier, after recent failures, movement events in other cities that had blown up in their face and devolved into violence. So here in 1968, it was not just like the snowball rolling down the hill. It was actually like still highly chaotic, and many of y'all remember that time very well. So he's there inviting people to remember to hold fast to the nonviolent principles, which we've talked about quite a lot, and also to remember that they have power in numbers. And he talks a little bit about the economic power that they have with numbers, if you read it, recognizing like, hey, citizens of Memphis, you can exert an extraordinary amount of influence on this city simply by the way places that you spend your dollars. Where do you invest your money in a bank? Where do you shop? What drinks do you drink? Etc. And he's like, you better believe they will start listening to you if you work together. Please.
Actually, it's interesting because it kind of ties together to the last comment. So I don't know if I have a direct answer to your question about like the moment when being kind of turned into saying yes, you know, waiting or whatever. But it reminded me of this part of a book called The Power of Habit, which is about basically just, it's about making good habits. Mm-hmm. But they use as an example, I think it was the Selma March, and how basically there were all these different church community groups. I guess we'd call them small groups, whatever in today's society, or prayer groups. You know, there were these small groups of people that would get together in their homes and pray and Bible study and all that. And basically, they started, you know, talking about like things that they could be doing, and different pastors were getting wind of like people being eager for change. And one night, and this is all based on memory, so this could be a little bit inaccurate from the way the book depicted it, and I'm not really sure what the source of the book was, but this is the way the story rings in my head. These pastors called on King, like on the phone, and said, you need to leave. You need to round up these people and organize. And he was like, what? Me? And he was like, I'll think about it. Hung up. Was not planning to say yes. And then they just kept calling him. And they wouldn't stop calling him. He was finally like, fine, I'll do it. And he started talking to these groups of people. And the thing in the Power of Habit is about how social change happens because of basically peer pressure. So if you're in a small group and everyone in the group is like, I'm going to show up for the march, and then you get cold feet, but you know everyone else is going to be there, you show up too. Even if you're afraid. In a way, that's what they're saying happened to King. Like everyone is saying, we all got to show up. You got to leave. Come on with us. And finally, it was just like, fine, I'll do it. And everyone else was that way too when it came to like actually showing up. And I think that's interesting because it points to one, what the gentleman in the front row was saying about the strength of your faith that really doesn't have to do with you and your fear. You know, God intervening and giving you the faith you need to show up. And also just the fact that God is leading our leaders when they're showing up. You know, he was a man and he had fear. But it wasn't just him acting and making a choice to show up. It was coming. It was
from somewhere.
It was coming from God.
Yeah.
And anyway, I just thought that was interesting because maybe it wasn't really his choice.
Well, he was in his 20s, if you remember when he started.
Yes,
20. A respectful person would, at 27, 28, say, yes, would defer.
Would have waited until they were 30.
At least. Yeah.
Well, at least.
Yes. Yeah. And we also remember that story which we read at the opening of the class, when he, after his home was bombed, and he's sitting in his, at his kitchen table in the middle of the night, and he is just racked with fears and uncertainties, and he has this moment of prayer. Do you remember that prayer? He prays. He's like, I am...
Gethsemane moment.
He is. It's Gethsemane. And he is given this moment of transcendent peace, which overwhelms the fears and prepares him to continue to move forward.
I also think, in terms of like the message that that story gives to our elders, in recognizing things in people that are younger and giving them the platform and the confidence and the call to step up, to go into it, to be who they are. I mean, that's powerful, because otherwise those people wouldn't ever have that opportunity or platform, or even the confidence to just do.
Yeah. I'm reminded of the thing I read last week, which Michael and Cherry brought to my attention, the one about Jonathan Daniels, where they're on the front line and they're all linked arm in arm and they're agitating, and they're front with the crowd control, the police who are there as crowd control, and there's an old Episcopal priest there who's like getting in people's face and actually making things not great. He's elevating the anxiety and the tension of the situation, and it's the kids who are there that day who are singing and who de-escalated the tension of the day and made it possible for Jonathan Daniels to have that profound moment of seeing the humanity of that single police officer. And because of that, it really changed the course of his life. Sometimes it is the youth who have the potential to show us a holier way.
You know what other powerful tool he had, though? His wife.
Yeah, I was about to say.
His wife was always there, and you hear people talk about pillow talk, but he had some of his deepest, most intimate vetting of his soul to her. And, you know, she's three babies and things like that. Mm-hmm. The house had just been bombed. Dad visited 3 days later. He was scared to death. And but she's the one, particularly as he sat at the kitchen table.
Indeed.
She said, this is not what you want to do, but this is something you must do.
Hmm.
And that was the tipping point. It wasn't everybody calling. I mean, sure, she heard the same thing, and so did the FBI and the police, because that was still punch phones, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People were always listening in and taking, but she's the one that gave him his ultimate strength to go ahead. Because he, like any man, I'm going to protect my family first and foremost.
Hmm.
You know, faith and everything was powerful, but I made a commitment to this woman. This woman bore me children. And that's where I need to place all my protective energies.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, no, this is a little bit bigger than us.
Yeah.
We don't pay enough attention to her because in his ministry and all the rest. I remember seeing her at his funeral and realizing she really is almost like the Virgin Mary cradled in her dead son under the cross. You know, she had given him to the country
and lost him. Pietà. So, I want to. We have about 4 minutes left. I want to do two things. I want to bring us back to Dr. King as a Christian leader who models for us, is not just a moral exemplar that we can put in a textbook and admire behind a glass case, but as a Christian leader who models for us the virtues and the behaviors that we are called to demonstrate in our own unique circumstances today. And I'm struck by his little imaginative exercise at the beginning of the sermon. When he says, he does that little thought exercise. If I could go anywhere in time, if I could go anywhere in history, where would I go? And he like does that thing where he goes to Egypt and he flies through time and he goes to ancient Greece and then he goes to ancient Rome and then he skips forward in time and he sees his namesake Martin Luther attacking the 95 Theses on the door of the Wittenberg, Wittenberg in Germany, and then he fast forwards again and he says that he would rather be then than anywhere else in time. He would rather be in the second half of the 20th century. If he could be anywhere in time, he wants to be where he is. And he says, now that's a strange statement to make because the world is all messed up. The nation is sick. Trouble is in the land. Confusion all around. But I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. And I see God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men in some strange way are responding. Something is happening in our world. The masses are rising up, and wherever they are assembled today, the cry is always the same. We want to be free. I am struck by his incredible capacity to see that he was placed at a particular time. He was supposed to be there at a particular time, and to look, even in the midst of the direst of circumstances, for where God was moving and transforming. In 1968, really at a low in his own leadership, in the nation's arc of justice, all the attention had shifted away from the Poor People's Campaign. All the air had been let out of that balloon. We were full Vietnam. He's at this low, and he's still looking for where he is, still grateful to be then, there then, and he's still looking for where God is. And I just find that to be extraordinary in our own day. As we pray with the psalmist, you know, oh, that we might see better times. And yet, Lord, thank you for the opportunity to be here now. I wonder, with 2 minutes to go, I wonder if any of you, and I would particularly love to hear from those whose voices have not necessarily been heard today, have learned something new, have come to a new discovery in these 7 weeks, have read something that you'd never read before, or thought something that had never really occurred to you before, or learned something that is changing the way you see not only Dr. King, but also your own life. I wonder if you've had any big or new thoughts. Barbara.
I've been like, kind of like typhoid Mary's, where we carry something that we're not even aware of, and that the only thing that can give us a vaccination or inoculation and make us not carriers is education. Because I want to go back to my high school and find out what they're doing for educating, because you don't know, then you can't connect the dots. And you can't see this horrible history that we have in our country that, you know, right now it's result, you know, it's the most visible form is the police brutality. But it's just, you know, my parents came here from the Midwest. They were in, like, you know, not very diverse areas. And they came into Dallas and they're like, well, why is there all this hatred? You know, why are some, you know, African-American people, you know, just like really angry and others aren't? And, you know, they had no understanding of Dallas. Zero.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's still going on, but I would suspect it is.
I suspect it is. So our responsibility then is to do as Dr. King clearly did, recognizing his example of self-education. Not just talking the talk, but doing the effort of educating himself about history, about contemporary events, never entering a place, a community that he hadn't done his homework on it, that we have a responsibility to do that, but also to pray with great fervency that we would never lose hope, that we would have the same hope that fed and nourished him in his life, that in the circumstances that beset us today, that we would hold fast to the courage and conviction and the hope that we need to keep going in our own day. Y'all, we've We've ended this class. The work is really beginning. I'm aware of that. I'm grateful for the privilege of getting to travel with a number of you on this coming pilgrimage. And know that if you are not able to travel on it, that we will come back with no doubt stories, but hopefully encouragement for all of us to make this kind of a pilgrimage and to embark on this kind of a journey. And we will bring stories back to hopefully, because we're going on behalf of everybody at Transfiguration. It's not just some of us going. We believe we're aspiring to do this for and with everybody together. So we'll try to help you one day make your journey, but we are going on your behalf as well. We ask for your prayers. We'll be leading a follow-up conversation in the weeks and months afterwards, much as we've done on the Holy Land pilgrimage and the South Africa pilgrimage. So stay tuned. I thank you for these 7 weeks of exploration. If you have other resources, do please use the Realm site. Post stuff up there. If something comes to you, find an article, a book, something, a story, post it up there. We'll keep that group going. So you will continue to be subscribed to that, and stuff you share there can be disseminated across the group, even though we won't necessarily be meeting here.
Father Casey, thank you for offering this class and for bringing this to our attention. And please keep leading us to not just say, well, that's over and we can go into something else.
Yeah. All right. Go in peace. Go in peace to love and serve the Lord.
Thanks be to God.